Session number 9339, Reel 16.
Mr. William Holbrook, Reel 16. I'd like to look at some of the things that came in during 1915-16 into trench warfare.
What do you mean?
Bombing would be
Of course, there was, as you said, Strachey's mortars that came about that time. And there was, the machine guns were altered. They were different. Where they were, not the Vickers Maxim guns, they came in the all these gen guns. You see things like that. There's improvement there. Then you've got to. They tried in people, of course, tin hats came up, seal helmets came in.
When was that?
That's in 1916.
What did you think of the steel helmets?
Well, I was going to tell you that all they issued when they first issued was two a battalion. You didn't get them all in there, or two a company, and they were the snipers. When it was snipers. He had gone gold. You wore the steel helmet. You see, and takes off. So, and when you used to walk from one place to another, minister kept on. They didn't want to carry them. There's only two things. I said, "Is it all bloody to carry them? Oh, they carried it yesterday. See, obviously." And they didn't like them at first. I mean, of course, gladly when everybody got them. Then there was another thing we had was the.
What did you think of yours when you got it?
Well, I didn't like it too much. It seemed heavy on your head. You know, you've been. Or even these sort of cap or an old-style khaki stocking, or we little thought the advantage it would be and the lives it would save. But
did you get used to it? How long did it?
Oh yes, you get used to it. Often. Yes, you carried them out. You took them round and bore them without any trouble. You didn't think more notes of it after about 6 months, I suppose, because we got used to it. You see, there was the periscope. They issued one of those to a platoon or company. And of course, the fellow's got to carry them. If he's on the long march, you've got to carry these damn things. They say, moan the fellows, because they say, you're damn termite. Then there's the woolly, then we got about that time the woolly sheepskin coat. That came about that time, all of them about that time.
What was that like?
Oh, it was a nuisance. It was a damn nuisance. They were warm. Can you imagine a man wearing a sheepskin coat woolly in a muddy trench? Well, you only got in one night, and it was absolutely useless. Covered with thick mud, and it's a weight to carry. The leather jerkin, that was better. It fit your clothes leather. That was all right. You wipe that down. That was very warm and good. It was a good thing.
What did you do with your sheepskin coat?
Oh, discard them since we could, but it got rid of them. In the end, they disappeared because they're absolutely useless. They must cost a lot of money. Millions must have been spent on them. Absolutely useless in frontline trenches.
But how long the leather jerkin, you'd keep that for?
Oh, yes. Yes, right to the whole length of the war. Of course, you lost some and got others. They were easy obtainable. It was very, very warm. They were warm and lovely, too. this sheepskin coat, they were ridiculous things, really. But I don't think anything else came in much of a turn.
What about the bombs? I mean, we haven't discussed that. Were there
We always had the bombs all the time. Yes, the Mills' bombs.
When did they arrive, Mills bombs? Because they weren't available right at the start.
Oh, no, that's not. No, about quite early, though. I suppose early part of 1915.
What can you remember about using Mills bombs?
Well, they were, because they're very awkward at first. In throwing them, you know, we had to throw dummy bombs at first if we got used to them, pulling out a pin and that. But I've known them to throw bombs and they'd pick them up and throw them back before they exploded. I don't do that. Well. Then this bomb throwing that you had to go through a course of bomb, you know, the bombers. They had special teams of bombers, you know, and they had to go a special course with a bomb sergeant, and he was the instructor, bomb instructor. But I remember, don't tell about this fellow, this strong fellow, come to the. Don't tell about him. Oh, well, about this time then, I was out at the line, and I was, even new fellows came in, I hadn't got used to, I don't know, I thought, I suppose, but I would make the CBS and T, and I'd get my Dixie. My daughter, I was pretty good. I said, come on, it's dark, we're going to make a cup of Dixie and T. So he predicted the night. I was out, so it was a wet, miserable night, and we were in bivouacs about 10 miles beyond the lines, I suppose, or less than that. And I was out on my own, it was a wet, miserable night, and I said, yeah, they didn't know what the youngsters lot were doing. Well, I call them youngsters, older than me, but I mean, I considered the service over. And I said, I'm going to make Dixie tea. Well, I've got this big Dixie tea going, and they were all sitting in this bivouac in the dark, and they lights in it. And I suppose about 8 to 10 in one, close together. And a draft that came out from England within an hour or so, because I didn't know anything about. And came out, we got two appointed to my bivouac. And I gave him around, and I saw this fellow there. I said, would you like a cup of mug of tea? So, I would be pleased to have one. He said, the other. So I said, you're all right. So I didn't come out. I said, I'll get it for you. I got an old Nestle's milk tin, which we should use a lot to have. And handed one to him. And as he took it from me, I saw he got enormous hands. You know, half dark, isn't he? Like the dictionary. And he got enormous hands. So I looked at him and said, God, I said, what hands you've got can help it? He said yes and laughed, and I found out that next morning he's Edward Ashton, Britain's strongest man. And now I used to read his book, Before the War of the Boy. Well, before the war, he's a little older than me, of course. Edward Ashton, what I think of the world of him, when I knew I was what I think of him. Well, what happened there, you talk about bombing, they wouldn't send him up the front line, he was too precious, too good as a gymnast instructor and that sort of thing. So He was a gymnast instructor up to us, you know, training and that sort of thing when we came out the line. And I saw him one day, when we was out the line, we used to get issued with loaves of bread, small loaves of bread, and in a sack. And in this sack, there'd be 30 loaves in a sack, and pretty weight with 30 loaves. And when you go and draw the ration from the dump, this sack of bread, you used to take one man just get on the, like another man was on the two bottom, walking along with two of them. So I was there when they came along, and I saw Ashton. He said, what's the car? He was moaning about this, but he said, what's about the car? Old? He said, I'll do that. He said, pick up one hand. Do you want to walk the road with it? And he even looked at him, you know. And another time I saw him hold back a GS wagon with four horses, and I saw him stop, so they couldn't move. Got like that and stopped it. He said, well, they sent it to on a bombing course, what do you think about bombs? Down to St. Mary, somewhere well down the line, where they used to train the bombers. And I never saw him anymore, but I somebody told me that the fellow again, I said, well, the first morning there to practice, and he said he goes out on the parade where he's bombing. This sergeant instructor, as long as the bomb had been thrown, there was about 50 some odd yards, you see, which was done by the sergeant. And because he's so he gave up this ash at the throw, he threw about 80. And he said he knew the thought he going to fit. They never in their lives. And he was unused to throwing it. Anyway, he got wounded by a bomb down there, so I never saw him before. Then with
an accident.
Yeah.
Did you ever go on a bombing course?
Not the course, no. I've done the bombing course, but we had to do ours. They didn't send us away. You sent most of the new men away. The older ones, they kept for the front line, you know, and more for that sort of thing. Gave you a live bombing better.
Did you ever throw them in the trenches, you know, in action, so to speak?
Oh, yes. We throw it, and as I call this, exploding, but quite a few number of yards. I was in there one morning, the fellow threw on it and hit the back of the trench with it. And he fell out of his hand and killed two of them. Fell into the trench before he'd get up. And then I saw another accident there where, this was at Arras, where a bomb, so a fellow, he's digging a kind of a bit of a, behind a bit of a shelter for make a drop of tea in the Dixie, and as they got some wood or something, they then put the fire and they lit it and put two bombs there, killed both of them, blew up as the fire started. They dig up the bombs went and killed both of them. But they had a lot of accidents, that sort of thing. It was very nasty.
Did it make you nervous whilst throwing them, or at all, or
no,
or just
not careful, got used to it, really. No.
Did the Germans bomb our trenches at
yes,
all?
Yes, yes. They had what they call a... what was it now called? It was a long bomb, about the big round, like a metal bomb, and on a stick. And they used to throw these on the stick. And so, oh, cool. I've only got four of them. the German bombs. I can't be like that. But that was the then what they used to do. I mean, you can't think, you put this in there. We got issued with what they call McConaughey's, Tins of McConaughey. That was the name of the firm that made it. They had a meat and veal, meat and vegetable. Tins about like that. And
six inches round. About 6 inches
across. Yes. And about an inch and a half depth, or and then that was this red mold. You just prick the tin a bit, so you see, and held it, put it open, all the fire blaze, the sand, and used to warm it up, you know, because it was a nice meal. What they used to do for dinner time, we had those them at night, not very often, now and again. What they used to do was to open them, do the business thing, what else, you do that. When they empty, you know, close it out and throw it across the German lines. And I've seen them throw it back. They said, "When did you bet?" Yes.
Was German bombing very effective or dangerous to you, or could you keep your eye open for bombs?
Well, once we knew if we were near, because you couldn't throw them far away, but sometimes we were very near. I've been near, it was like 50 yards or 30 yards, or because it was very near, and they could. But in a military case, you could say that the lines were usually 100 yards back or something. 70, 80, well, they couldn't do that. They couldn't throw them there. So they, of course, they then use shells. if the trench was too near, they couldn't shell because their shells were likely to fall on their own trenches. So that was something God sent, and sometimes not.
Talk about developments. You said earlier that in early 1915 they didn't have any proper latrine facilities.
No.
Did they start to develop that sort of thing later on in the trenches, special latrine trenches?
Well, I don't know, not in the trenches, no. No.
It was still very makeshift.
You had to go back behind the lines for that, you know, crawl out beyond the undercover, of course. You know. Oh, no, you wouldn't get it. You have to. They try and get concentrating once what they could, and I mean, used it, but. Oh no, it was very awkward. Men would do it in the dark, you know, and then other people would go out and use the water to make tea with, and all that sort of. I was at one part, this is 1915, and we've been shelled very heavily. I remember what made me laugh, things remember that. One fellow was near me, crouching near me, and they shouldn't have dropped me near the line. He said, calm, like, he said, I wonder who's refereeing this contest. I remember those things are like. Anyway, there's a lot of cockneys, you know. They'd been out to, some being out to use this the shell, we got their water, as something using as a latrine, you see. So, before, when they started shelling us, we got a bit of an old brazier in one of the shelters there, the shelter dug out, and they got a big can of this water on board, if we could make some tea up, we could. And of course, this shelling stopped, we had to clear off into the trench undercover. And when we got back, after about 20 minutes, I suppose, got back into the other game. This water was boiling, and I said, "That's your urine there, isn't there?" I said, "You can make tea with that." So he said, "Well, it's all we got." I said, "Well, if it is not, we'll have none of that." I said, "They've been using, must be using urinating where you've been getting the water from." So he said, "Well," he said, "we've got it in now, without the tea's in it." He said, "I said, I'm getting tea tonight." I drank it. Well, I said I couldn't touch that. I'd be how thirsty I was. That stuff I know. Yes, we're very crude.
So, by the time you left Ypres, there still hadn't been anything done about digging proper trenches for the trees?
No.
What about dugouts? You mentioned dugouts there. Well, had this come in a bit more now?
No, the first dugout I really, a deep dugout, got was on the Somme.
We'll come to that later.
Yeah, that was German.
Had the smaller dugouts have been expanded a little?
No, what happened there, well, they try and get out there and build some kind of thing. It wouldn't build it, but dig in the ground behind the trench, perhaps in the support line within. They used to have what they called funk holes. And they dig them in the side of the front, you see your front trench, front parapet, wasn't behind, but down level with the, or a little above the bottom of the trench, they dig in and they curl up there for the night, because you get one after one man curled in a little hole. This is where you got these sleepwalkers. And then the trenches being very narrow, fellows might as well kick them, they couldn't help it. So nobody ever got really they were, say, 2-3 hours off. They couldn't get sleep because they were disturbed so much. They would cuddle up like this, both in the little hole, and then some come along and kick your feet. But there's no sleeping room or fetish. They're going to have a parapet of sleep. But no, when they weren't on duty, you know, but there were no provision made for anything like that, not a bit. No provision for, of course, it wasn't for the bad weather. Sometimes we had to walk the sheep, but very rarely. We had a great coat, but the waterproof sheep was... Sometimes we got one, but very rarely.
When did they start arriving, waterproof sheets?
They went soon after the war started. They got a few, not many. They were mostly cover up the gums and things like that, so they wouldn't get rusty and wet. But then we got each with one each. That lasted some time, practically, but they're so damn heavy that some fit them carry them.
When did you first get any gas shells or gas attacks?
That would be in 1915.
Where were you doing the big German gas attack at Ypres, at Battle of
Somme? That's what I'm talking about.
Were you in the line at that time?
Well, I was in reserve. Canadians were there.
What can you remember about that?
Well, the first thing about that, our battalion was out about, I'd say, 6 miles or something beyond the lines, in reserve, waiting for them. And it's in a bit of a wood where we are. And I was walking, I saw this bird, a bird on there, and it just fell off. It fell off the tree. It was me. I said, well, and I looked, I couldn't understand it. So I said, that bird fell down off there. I said, well, there's anything wrong with it. Look at it, couldn't see anything wrong with it. And it had been gassed, and they got the gas, well, we did. But we didn't get much, not the first issue. We had a kind of... went to support the Canadians, but another funny part about it was that with the Canadians coming out, when I was at Hounslow, when I first joined, the officer in my company was named Birchall, the left hand of the knife man, who was Birchall, and I was only a boy, and that's his three, so he's very kind to me, and I thought ever so much of him. Well, he'd have to go to Canada, take over a position in Canada. Of course, I never saw more of him. But when the Canadian came over, he was in charge of them, Birchall, as a colonel. And I remember, I think he got killed, I'm not sure, but I remember when the gas first started, put the gas over, Birchall and the Canadian were at the front line, and Birchall was apparently, with our new air officers there, was having a bit of a meal with some of our officers. See, when the news came through, the Canadians had retreated, and some of our artillery had been captured, and Birchall goes forward with the stick. And he leads them back, got them back, and they capture some of the guns, but of course they were badly attacked by gas. But we fell back quite a lot there, 7 or 8 miles or something, more than that.
Were you actually involved in any of the fighting at Second Ypres?
It was like a continuation. We never left there. See, I went to Ypres in 1914, October 1914, and I didn't come away from there. Backwards and forwards, it might have gone a little part of the Kemmel than that, but really, even Kemmel was in the salient, that part of the salient.
So you didn't see it as a separate battle, but the Battle of Second Ypres? It wasn't to you a separate battle at all?
No, it was a continuation of it as far as we were concerned.
Do you remember any mass German attacks at that time?
Yes, in the 1914.
No, I mean in 1915.
1915, yes.
Or were you out of the line during that period? You weren't pulled back into the line?
I was in the line.
Because you said you were in reserve when the Germans attacked gas. Were you then pulled back into the line?
Yeah, we weren't reserve for any length of time. Only like our reserve 4 days and so on. Only what we used to call that reserve. It wasn't reserve because you only wait 4 days.
So when you came back to the line, did you notice any difference in the new German attacks during what the historians call the battle?
Of course, yes, they drew the Canadian back some. We took over... We had to dig new trenches. We'll take out the reserve trenches where the Canadians had fallen back to. But after a guy, we recovered a lot of that afterwards. Then they started building blockhouses, like made of concrete, big concrete, which they...
Whenabouts would that be, that if you saw your first
blockhouse? About 1916. And they had machine guns in there, and a hell of a job of getting out, they were. Was it, well, yes, it was a semi-block out. No, wait a minute, I've got to think now, Kemmel. just off the Kemmel, we had an officer named Hudson. No, we had a Blackmore. Yes, a Black. We had the cross on Black people. He was the son of the people. The people. Nice, but he's an officer. He'd been in the Honourable Artillery Company, and they used to supply their men, most of the officers of the fugitives, the Londoners, you see, and they used to get a lot of offers from this on the team. Well, Blackwell was one. And I met this Blackwell, we were attacking a bit of a kind of a pillbox there.
When was that? In 1916?
No, before then. We took it out sometime about the middle September of 1915. And they weren't the proper blockhouse, but they was houses. They were any house that was anywhere near. They'd cement it up, you know, made it stronger. Well, and he put the machine gun in, and they killed our captain. Our captain got killed by. He was an Adventist. Mickey Hudson was our captain. He got killed there by a shell fire. I was in the line there with him when he got killed there, and he got killed. And Blackmore, a lieutenant, he went mad. He thought the world of this Mick Ellison. And he jumps up. He said, "I'll never do that to my captain." He said, I'll kill the buggers," he said, because he never came back. That was Blackmore. That was the first Blackmore. Then, going further on, then we had another Blackmore. So in the course of the war, we had three Blackmore sons in my company. And first one, Blackmore, this one that got killed. Well, going back to him again, doing this gas business. When we first saw the gas, we got the gas was being used. We were out the west somewhere or other, behind the lantern, and it's a bit of a wood with the burden there. And this Blackwell's servant, they've got a son called Williams. A little short for me, look what a cop he was. And we were there for about 20 days, and Blackwell was they all liked him, because you know, he used to treat the troops every single put their money and that millionaires. And that, so I remember the people, I was near this, there's an order, any message, and he wanted this, wanted his servant, so I remember I'd seen there, he called that Williams was in where I was, the old bugger in me, he said, "Williams," you see, and gone out and said, "Williams," he shouted, "no, what are you?" And suddenly you could hear Blackwell, lumber, damn great, but about 6 feet 4, you him coming along, you know, so Williams jumped up and started going out, and I remember him saying to him, he said, "Williams," he said, he said, "the bloody Germans were after you. We said, you move past, what do you do now?"
Were you given any instructions about precautions to take about gas?
Yes. No, nothing we hadn't. Nothing whatever. The first we had was when we used to have our mouthpiece, you know, used to wash it and put in urine, all that sort, you know, and pee on it. And then, I remember on one occasion we had to go through test. It was mustard gas, I think, with testing. We had to go through they then erected kind of tents, blocked up tents, not high tents, and you had to go through one end wearing the gas mask, you see, and walk the whole length of it, breathing through, like that, and see if what effect. It was very good, it had no effect on it at all. We used to go through clear, like, testing this gas. But the up there by it, what was it? The ground was saturated a lot. It wasn't too bad, first of all. I used this gas, but not. Didn't continually use it. They didn't use gas shells and all that sort of thing. You see, they had this first lot of gas coming over, first lot of gas, but then they just seemed to stop. And I never got any more gas really, till the Somme. I got the gas. It was bad there.
But during the years you were, the 18 months you were at Ypres, did you notice any change in the ground conditions? You know, generally.
Oh yes, they got used to the people moved back. You see the civilians that they moved back from, and we occupied ground at a greater depth than the front line, and this is occupied. The troops were coming up in their thousands then, see, to support the.
What effect did the fighting have on the ground conditions, though? The drainage and the number of shell holes, things like that. How did the battlefield start to look?
It was very, very wet, of course, up in Flanders. And as you dug down, the water come up from the, you know, the more you dug, the more water. So it's a hell of a job bailing out all that sort of thing and putting sand. We were getting, at that time, we were getting lots of, hundreds and hundreds of sandbags, empty bags, you know. And we used to fill those, of course, and drop those on and build a parapet with those too. They save a lot of work. with thousands of semi come up, and we'd get behind them and fill them with earth, and then bring them up top of the. What the Germans used to do, if they're fairly high, they'd train the light shell, the whiz bangs, onto the parapet, blow a hole in the parapet
across.
Then they train their machine on it. See, so you couldn't repair. We try to repair. We stand back a bit so the bag like actually bump up the good machine gun to go off. And it was a bit of a job there. But gas wasn't.
What was the condition of the battlefield like? Could you describe it? What it looked like? Oh, generally,
nothing but mud and trenches, communication trenches taken here and lost there, and it was nothing but the jumble of the mud and crisscross trenches and that sort of thing. I remember we got so in the trenches we could pass one another. In the second battle, we got so we could pass one another. You couldn't pass one another in the trenches, it was too narrow, but when it was dark, you'd pass one another on top. And the fellas in the trenches was almost cut the surface. It must have been up to his shoulder then. He was getting a narrow trench up to his shoulder. But it was dugouts, of course. And then you'd move out and they'd move in, because you couldn't move out till for them. We should be behind the. We'd wait sometimes about 4 or 5 days behind the lines. This was at Ypres, the second back of Ypres. I was at a place called Dicky Bush, and. It's on the same map, and what's the name? Sanctuary Wood. And this Dicky Bush, I was waiting to go up the line one night. We were going to relieve the we were in this little village behind the line, and we couldn't go up till it was dark. We got about another hour to wait, and we didn't know what to do. You know, so the troops there was saying about this village, isn't it? And I was in some of the houses, people left the village and different villages, and. I was waiting there. While I was waiting there, in this garden, there's a big heap of potatoes. Seeing this, they'd left them great heap of potato people, getting left it. And these people, I got a broom handle, a broomstick. I was in, got the other one. It was blending up a cricket. And we went far. We done about 6 miles from the line. We're moving up about an hour, and I was playing the game cricket. And the fella, as they hit me big potatoes, I was hitting them with a cricket. And one of the fellas there. Picked up half a brick, this a broken brick, and I didn't know in the half dark, and I picked it into it and hit the bottom of my broom handle, ran up the handle and knocked all my teeth out, or not in the state, I knocked all my teeth out, went right across here, it blacked two eyes, bummed my nose up, broke all my teeth on the front top and a few on the back one.
You told me about that earlier, and how after the war your teeth were fixed, but
yes.
In civilian life.
Yes.
But how come you didn't get any dental treatment while you were in the army?
No, not a bit. Not anything. I had nothing taken out of the door, nothing. I kept those broken teeth down the whole of the time.
Was this? Did you choose not to have treatment?
Well, didn't have it.
Or was it non-available?
Oh, no, not available.
Cause you a lot of pain for
well, it did the first fortnight or so, but after I got used to it, I suppose, and I didn't. I should eat with it, so there's all. I couldn't eat biscuits, so soaked up my water. Because they're too hard, I got used to it. They're just little stumps. But I went through the whole wall like that.
And that was done in 1915, 16?
Yes, they were still there till I came home in 1919. I hadn't taken out, because I remember, did I tell you about the dentist?
Yes.
What he said.